Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode is all about the right's realignment when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. I'm speaking with Jacob Halperin. He is the editor of The National Interest, and he has a new book out today. It's called America Last, The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. Now, before you just dismiss this book as just another Trump is Hitler or, you know, Russiagate book from the 2010s, Jacob's done something really interesting here. He has taken for granted the obvious fact that during the 20th century, there are plenty of people on the left that were way too credulous or naive towards communism, socialism, and the Soviet Union, and taken that same lens when it comes to vulnerability and applied it to the right. From World War I all the way through the end of the Soviet Union, there were plenty of people on the American right that were just as friendly to foreign authoritarian right-wing dictators as some on the left were friendly towards left-wing dictators. So he's taking this theme of a right-wing penchant for foreign dictatorship and applying it to the foreign policy debates of the 2020s. You're seeing this in the category of going beyond just critiquing NATO and the Iraq war and the U.S. foreign policy elite, and then instead going further and cozying up to Vladimir Putin and making statements that kind of defend his actions. So navigating the line between those two things, one of which is perfectly legitimate, the other one is deeply unserious, is very important. Jacob's book is the perfect way to think through this dynamic. Hope you all enjoy this conversation, and a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Jacob Halperin, welcome to The Realignment. Actually, welcome back to The Realignment. I had you back on the show in 2022. So now that you have a book out, it's great to be with you again.
Thank you.
Let's just be clear about something. I know that whataboutism is deeply unfashionable and actually like a huge problem in the space that we're talking about here. But I want to kind of open with a statement that I think will ground this conversation for listeners who are going to be skeptical, thinking, oh, is this just another, you know, right-wingers or fascists, Trump democracy, X, Y, and Z thing. So here's the statement I'll make. Over the past 100 years, the time scope of your book, it's been pretty clear that the political left in this country and the political right in this country have a specific problem in their own ways. On the political left side, there's a long tradition of folks acting in good faith and bad faith, being overtly naive and sympathetic to communist regimes, early Soviet Union, dictatorship as you move into the 1950s and 60s, and so on. On the right, then, the phenomenon you're describing is a real tendency on the American right to be sympathetic towards authoritarian right-wing dictatorships. Would you agree that that's a fair assessment of a political dynamic that's happened on both sides of like the ideological spectrum over the past century?
100%.
Okay, so then, go on.
No question, and I'm amused by this. I put in the introduction to my book that I noted this left-wing phenomenon, and I think they're exactly parallel for different reasons. But what I'm amused, Walter Russell Mead, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, yesterday tweeted at me, now do Lenin, Ho Chi Minh, Mao, and so forth. I pointed out, first of all, I've written extensively on those topics, and there are innumerable books recounting the left-wing fellow travelers. This is no secret. It's a discreditable record. I'm not trying to allege that the right has some kind of monopoly on romanticizing authoritarian governments. What's interesting is that, as far as I know, no one has systematically looked at this history and pulled it all together. And that's what I tried to do.
And that's the key thing here, because if, let's say, the worst version of AOC was in charge of the Democratic Party, or if Bernie Sanders had won the Democratic Party's nomination in 2020, examining the question of, oh, Bernie, you honeymooned in the Soviet Union during the latter stages of the Cold War. That's interesting. That displays a degree of naivete or lack of, I think, like self-reflection around like the nature of like communism in the 20th century. I think analyzing the left end of that spectrum wouldn't just be whataboutist. I think it would deeply speak to policy questions. But the actual point is, just from reading your book, if we're looking at these intra-right debates – There's a really of the moment deep mattering to the question of why are certain folks on the right, certain institutions on the right, drawn to certain right-wing international figures at a level beyond a good faith, let's have a debate about to the degree to which the United States should be involved in the world. I just cannot think of a single public policy question in this moment that hinges on Jake Sullivan having, you know, strong feelings for Ho Chi Minh. It just doesn't exist. So I'm just curious about how you think about that dynamic.
Right. I think that on the right, it's been the same phenomenon as on the left. And what's the impulse? The impulse is to look at Vladimir Putin, or even more, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, as a model for the United States, to argue that, as Tucker Carlson did on his recent visit to Moscow, he didn't just say things are okay in Moscow. He said they're better than they are in the United States. Their food is better. Their food is cheaper. The metro system is better. America, he seems to purport to claim, doesn't match up to Putin's Russia. Of course, it's nonsensical, but it's no different than the fellow travelers in the 1930s on the left going to Russia and claiming that everything is fine and dandy, even as Stalin is slaughtering millions in the Gulag. Whether it's George Bernard Shaw or Walter Duranty of the New York Times, who covered up the Ukrainian famine, who defended the purge trials, who said that everything was flourishing in the Soviet Union and got a Pulitzer Prize for it, incidentally. Shameful. No less shameful, however, is Tucker Carlson, who knows better and goes over there and pretends that everything is hunky-dory in Putin's Russia, because they would like to install an authoritarian system here in Washington, D.C. For me, totally unacceptable.
So this is where we need to get into the good faith versus bad faith. You're looking at a period over 100 years, and during those 100 years, there are different conflicts, there are different questions, certain movements on the ascendancy, including figures, and during other moments, they are not. What would you say is the dividing line between a good faith, look, there just are different countries that do things more effectively than we do. Like, for example, think of your most 2011 Tom Friedman column. Look at Singapore. They have a brilliant airport, and our airports look like crap. Like, what's the difference between seeing figures, movements, and realities outside our borders and saying we need to make things better here, or if we're doing something better there, and the phenomenon you're critiquing when it comes to Tucker?
I think it's, look, the United States has egregious deficiencies. We know that. You can go to the Scandinavian countries, you can go to Germany, you can go to Japan. You can see that the train systems are running far more effectively and efficiently in, say, Japan or France than they are in the United States. If you so believe, you can argue that the welfare systems are more extensive, that they lead to more harmonious societies. You can look at Singapore and call it a model of efficiency, but once you start poking underneath, why? Is it because it's an authoritarian system? That's where I start to get the willies. When there is a dividing line between understanding a foreign society and engaging in apologetics for it. The apologetics come when you argue that the authoritarianism is the essential ingredient and that that's what we should be emulating in the United States. I don't buy it for a number of reasons, one of which is I do believe in a tamed version of capitalism. I believe in personal liberty and freedom, and I don't think that it's necessary to sacrifice them to accomplish economic gains. And in fact, if we look at authoritarian countries, by and large, they are not the most effective economically. I mean, Mussolini's Italy was not economically effective. Hitler's economy was based on a war economy. It was an artificial boom that he created in the 1930s. I don't think that's the road we want to go down, and I don't think it's necessary. For me, the key throughout this, the more I think about it, is George Orwell. Because Orwell was unflinching about criticizing both the right and the left. We need to remain intellectually honest here. That when I see Tucker Carlson or Tommy Tuberville, the senator, defending Putin, it's stomach churning, frankly.
I think the key difference here between, let's say, like the Nordic example, or longing for some aspect, even of like Singaporean authoritarianism in their own context, would be whether the actual thing you're longing for is true or not. So once again, the flaw in the left view in the 1930s is that the version of the Soviet Union they were lauding was just a lie. It was a Potemkin village. It wasn't real. And people like Durant here, obviously, actively lying in favor of that model. And then in the case of the fascists in Europe, they were looking at things that just weren't true. You could look at a lot of these diaries or these articulations were happening, and it wasn't true. So basically, what are people on the American right in the United States who are sympathetic to these authoritarian models? What do they think they are seeing and lauding that you think when you actually look into it is ersatz, is not real, is propaganda, that they're either falling for purposefully or unpurposefully?
Well, Trump's contention is that America is falling into an abyss, that we have lawless cities, that crime is flourishing, we have illegal immigrants pouring over the border, that our country is collapsing, and that Joe Biden is presiding over his own campaign of intimidation. And so what the right is arguing is, and that we've had a grotesque expansion of personal rights in the United States. For example, you saw Samuel Alito, the Supreme Court justice yesterday, complaining about the Supreme Court's decision several years ago to legitimize gay marriage. And he said that this is turning people who oppose homosexuality, and it gives everyone in America free license to call them bigots when they should be perfect, when they should perfectly have the right to condemn this practice and this way of life. So conservatives are glomming on to Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin as exemplars. Vladimir Putin is sending his secret police into Moscow bars to nab gay people. He's going into gay bars and they're imprisoning these people. There is a campaign in the Russia against gay marriage. I mean, it's absolutely taboo. They're cracking down on transgender people. They purport to stand up for traditional Christian family values. Viktor Orban, similarly, he has cracked down on any form of immigration into the country. He has what he calls pro-family policies, including state subsidies for if you have several children. They want white children in Hungary. Our conservatives, including Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts, who traveled to CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference, last May in Budapest, which I witnessed. I was denied entry into it, but I did follow the conference and wrote about it for Politico. Kevin Roberts sees and declares that Viktor Orban is a hero. This is what they want to create here in Washington, should Trump become president. Now, the question hanging over all of this is there's a difference between intention and ability to execute. Sam Adler Bell from Know Your Enemy wrote a long op-ed in the New York Times questioning whether conservatives are organized and coherent enough to carry out these plans. That's the real question. But there's no question that they pine in a somewhat romantic fashion for authoritarianism.
So I guess it seems to me that part of your, I get what you're saying about Trump claiming apocalyptic visions of decline, but as I look at the American political system, the part that really seems to rhyme with the 1930s period right now, really, and then obviously the 70s in its own way, is really just the feeling of malaise, the lack of confidence in the system. So once again, like we could say that, like, okay, like crime rates outside of DC have like fallen after like the COVID high. So we can kind of like nitpick all the different like versions of like actually things aren't as bad as Trump would basically say. But I would say clearly a political reality in this country is a lack of faith, both like in the system and just in the political mood of the country, which is separated from whether or not the stock market is perfectly performing well. Obviously, during the Great Depression, things were much, much worse on every single level, but that type of economic rebuke also serves to undermine confidence in the system, which then creates a space where left authoritarianism and right authoritarianism could like fill the gap here. I guess from your perspective then, as someone who surveys the American right, and then wrote a book on neoconservatism back when that was really the flavor of the day in the 2000s. I'd love for you, I believe that book came out in 2007, 2008. I'd love for you to kind of narrate what happened between the end of the Bush administration and our conversation today that made the conversation no longer be neoconservatism as this driving idea, separate, because once again, there weren't that many neocons, yet neoconservative ideas clearly played a role in setting the table. I think the metaphor also works when you're looking at people on the right in America who are interested in authoritarian models and visions. What happened over the past 15 years?
The Iraq War is what happened. It discredited interventionism and fighting for democracy abroad, because the Bush administration's war was based on lies and it was a debacle. And that opened the door to the traditional right, the old right, returning to seize power in the GOP. And what's so fascinating about that is the neocons essentially ruled the roost in foreign policy from about the mid-70s throughout the Iraq War, so till about 2008. But then you start to have that backlash in the GOP. It took a couple years, but it was Donald Trump, who is in many ways the heir of Patrick J. Buchanan. Buchanan kept the isolationist flame flickering after World War II. He served both in the Nixon and the Reagan administrations. And Trump picked up many of the themes that Buchanan espoused. We should leave NATO, trade deals are to America's disadvantage, and we should not belong to international organizations like the UN. And above all, we should not engage in feckless wars abroad that drain our treasury. So it was more of a, they were, and Buchanan explicitly talked about national, about America first. So Trump in the South Carolina primary in 2016 breaks the ice. He announces to the audience that we were lied to about weapons of mass destruction. Now, this was heresy in Republican ranks, but Trump managed to win and push this through. He was the first candidate that explicitly stated we need to move away from George W. Bush interventionism and embrace America first. And that is why today Trump is now even successfully pushing a large swath of the Republican Party to abandon the Cold War hostility to Russia and to become, in effect, pro-Russian today.
Something I'm curious about, because it's easy to dunk on the Tucker grocery store trip in many ways. Even parts of the online Twitter right I follow that are not in agreement with you on foreign policy, I think there's a clear, this was a jumping the shark moment. I think he got a bit overexcited. And that just was, frankly, just indefensible. It's like ridiculous to claim that Russians in their grocery stores have like a comparable or favorable experience to people in the United States. That said, though, there are parts of this critique. The ones that I'm most fascinated by are ones where, even where I don't disagree with them, I agree. I get what they're getting at. So, for example, when Tucker, when Senator J.D. Vance, when Trump are bemoaning the European security apparatus, it's just empirically true that A, it doesn't feel that the Europeans are moving with the speed and necessity one would hope they would, in a world where Donald Trump could easily come back and become president and pull out of NATO. Clearly, there was a lot of end of history thinking, especially in Western Europe. So I guess what I'd love to hear from you is, what are the critiques that the right isolationists make that you're most understanding and sympathetic to, and that could be disentangled from the weird Hungary standing, which I've personally been literally in the room with? It's very strange. But I think we just have to, I think as intellectuals trying to sort through this moment, these have to be kind of separated, because one could be adjudicated, aka also like, let's not invade Iraq again. There's a real lesson there that we could take. But I'd love to hear what you think the legitimate critiques are.
You're right, because not every person that is opposed to the Ukraine war or that wants to pull the United States out of NATO is pro-Putin. I mean, that would be a slur, or pro-Hungary. That's not ipso facto the case. There is a legitimate tradition of isolationism in the United States going back to the beginning of our history. I would be the last person to dispute that. I think it's a flawed view today under the circumstances we live in. But again, you can make a reasonable argument. The strongest critique against NATO is exactly the one that you just made, which is that the countries have been laggardly about spending on their own defense. They have been swaddled in illusions about what Putin is up to, and they have tried to accommodate his wishes over the past several decades, particularly German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I think there's been a sea change. You're seeing the expansion of NATO to include Sweden and Finland. The Germans are talking about trying to get to 3%, but it's difficult because you face internal problems in many of these countries. You have a far right movement in Germany, France, other in Holland, other countries that would like to accommodate Putin, that is not opposed to him. And the more you stress the budget and cut social spending and devote to the military, the more difficult it's going to become for the mainstream parties. Should the United States simply bail out of NATO? No, I think the track record is too strong. After 1945, and Europe is our biggest trading partner, after 1945, our prosperity and power have been greatly enhanced by stability in Europe. My guess is that if the United States simply pulled out, you would have a situation drifting towards chaos. The Europeans have never been able to get their act together. For better or worse, some form of American involvement in Europe is necessary. And I think the benefits far exceed the costs. That's why I do not believe that Trump is actually pursuing America's interests first. I think he, in effect, he's putting them last.
I think part of the difficulty here, and this is the difficulty for folks who are defending the post-World War II situation, is that if you're looking at NATO the way Trump looks at NATO, dollars and cents, how much he uses words like, not paying their dues, NATO doesn't have dues, but obviously he's metaphorically referring. I understand the metaphor. The metaphor, because the people could be annoying with the gotchas there. When he's saying they're not paying their dues, it's basically saying that there is this understood, there is this like implicit premise that if the US is going to dedicate its blood and treasure potentially to this region, the other players in the region are going to not just free ride and be serious. That's what he means by saying dues. I totally get the colloquialism there. However, if you just look at this from the perspective of the US puts in X and Y amount of money and doesn't get Y or Z out, you miss that ever since 45, we haven't had to go back into a European war. We haven't had World War I, World War II. You've had genuine stability and peace on the continent. And it just seems as if the isolationist right is unwilling if to you to look at the ledger that way. They're unwilling. And this is where I think the revisionism comes in. Because the way they counter this idea that there was this horrible world that we could live in if we didn't spend the money, they basically say, no, that world is a lie. That's where the revisionism comes in. So I'd love you to speak to this part of the book because I think a lot of folks would miss this. Why is historical revisionism, not just about the 1990s, not just about the 2000s, but going back to the Kaiser and the teens and the 20s, why is this a key way by which this ideology advances its worldview?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So in my book, America Last, I looked extensively at the debates after World War I that took place when Americans were disillusioned with the outcome of the war because Russia had collapsed into communism. There was turmoil in Germany. Eastern Europe was unstable. So the flourishing of democracies that Woodrow Wilson had promised did not occur. So a wave of right-wing revisionism, it wasn't just on the right, there was also on the left. We have to be careful about these terms in the early 20s because the parties hadn't really sorted themselves ideologically as much as they have now. But there was a wave of conservative revisionism that argued that America had been duped into the war by globalist elites, by Jewish bankers on Wall Street, and that we should not have aided Great Britain. We should have let Kaiser Wilhelm triumph, that Germany was a more advanced society. Prussian autocracy would have ensured order in Eastern and Central Europe, and it was an advanced industrial society, one that in many ways was superior to the United States. And that then morphed into the America First movement, which, you know, we often talk about isolationism, but some members of the America First movement, including Charles Lindbergh, again, weren't simply sympathetic to Nazi Germany. They actually admired it. They were pro-fascist, and they thought that we needed to impose a authoritarian regime here in the United States. One of the other leaders at the time, I don't mean to throw too many names, but Merwin Hart, a leading New York financier, a very influential figure in the America First movement before World War II, said, quote, "We need to brush aside this word democracy." And he was denounced by Roosevelt cabinet officials for that. These people did not believe in democracy. They thought democracy was the loser. They weren't actually dissimilar from the left wingers we're talking about, who had also given up on democracy. They thought communism was the answer. Some people in the America First movement thought that some form of Mussolini's or not even Nazism was necessary in the United States. After World War II, interestingly enough, the revisionists returned and made some of the same arguments that were made after World War I. There were conservatives who argued after World War II that we should not, again, they didn't give up. They said the only result of World War II was that we allowed Joseph Stalin to conquer Eastern Europe, and we should have let Hitler run roughshod and defeat Stalin. We aided the wrong country. We should not have aligned ourselves with Great Britain. And there was a strong movement in the Republican Party led by its titular head, Senator Robert Taft, who opposed American entry into NATO, who opposed the Marshall Plan, aiding Western Europe economically after World War II. So those sentiments never died away. And after the Cold War ends, they all return. We have a third wave of revisionism where conservatives such as Patrick Buchanan now blame the United States for the confrontation with Putin and over Ukraine. They say that we made Putin fearful, that we encircled him with NATO. Same arguments that you heard after World War I, by the way, that we encircled Wilhelmine Germany. So my bottom line is none of the arguments that we're hearing today are new. Donald Trump hasn't invented anything. He's simply recapitulating older arguments and presenting them as novel foreign policy doctrines.
And the key thing here that I think you do a good job of doing in the book, but I think some bad faith reviewers did not capture properly, is the point that you're making when you bring up the Kaiser and World War I is not that there were not very coherent cases against the United States continuing to maintain neutrality and not choosing sides between Great Britain and Germany. It's that there were certain parts of the political right that were not just, okay, it's not worth the blood and treasure, right? We should remain. We have, you know, the two oceans between us and Europe. It's the old world or the new world. But actually, there's this affirmative case for Kaiser Wilhelm. There's an affirmative case for monarchy. And that's really where I think we cross the line from good faith, fair debates about public policy into, wait, there's a jaded, warped worldview that takes opportunity over, once again, a lack of confidence, a lack of vision to really move. And I think you kind of saw this and I'm sure you could think of all these examples. You brought up the NATO expansion one. But the funniest bit of revisionism, because it's, to my perspective, the most insane is a lot of people online, Putin brought this up in his Tucker interview, I talk about, oh, you know, I was interested in joining NATO. Putin was interested in joining NATO. Clinton said it was a possibility. And if only, and it's just one of those situations where it says like, A, I think it Once again, the reason why revisionism frustrates me isn't because I disagree with the end. It's that it's clearly trying to shift the facts on the ground in order to determine the debate. So when they say Putin wanted to join NATO, what they're saying is they're not actually making a serious proposal that, like, murderous, like, he's in the middle of Chechnya and everything, Putin enter into the hen house because he's basically the ultimate fox there. They're basically saying, no, Putin was this chill, normal guy. And actually, it was those roguish, evil neocons who turned him into whatever he is today. Like, that's where the real disagreement is. If we were having a real agreement, if we could have a legitimate debate in 2000 about, okay, this is Putin, this is what he is, it's worth bringing him. It's like the LBJ quote, like, it's better to have him pissing from outside of the tent instead of inside of the tent. But that's different than the revisionist case.
If you look at Putin, I mean, he was an intelligence officer in Dresden before and then during the crash when the Berlin Wall came down. And I don't mean to suggest that Putin is at the level of Hitler, but you see Hitler after World War I is confined in the Pasewalk Hospital. He was temporarily blinded. And he emerges from the hospital and is intent on revenge because he sees he was convinced that Germany would win the war. He walks out of the hospital and sees utter chaos. Who does he blame? The Jews, the West. They're intent on annihilating Germany. It's time for payback. Devotes the rest of his life to that mission, single-mindedly. What does Vladimir Putin do? He packs up his washing machine in Dresden, drives with his then wife to St. Petersburg, and is apparently intent on revenge again. These guys, there's something in the water. And remember Putin's quote that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century? I think it's naive not to take these people seriously and at their word. I mean, Putin, we know, is a bloodthirsty killer. Look what just happened in Spain. They rubbed out that Russian who helicopter pilot who defected to Ukraine. Not only did they gun him down in a parking garage, they ran over his body, apparently. Then you have the killing of Alexei Navalny. You have the internal crackdown in Russia today. The West is not to blame for this. That doesn't mean that the West is blameless or hasn't made any mistakes in dealing with Russia. Not saying that. But you can't pin, it's an illusion to endow us with that kind of power, that we can single-handedly manipulate Russian society and that we are responsible for what's occurred there. We're not. Russia is, just as Germans were after World War I. So the revisionism is a legitimate part of America, of history. Look, we always revise, but is it done in an spirit of scholarly inquiry, or is it done with a political agenda? What struck me is that when you see the same slogans, the same verbiage used after World War I, after World War II, and then after the end of the Cold War, the same arguments, something is up here, and it's people on the right are using the same ideas. I'm just not convinced that this is persuasive. It's in fact what it is demagoguery.
I'm glad you just to put a pin in the conversation. I'm glad you brought up the Putin quote where he says that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because once again, to folks who are interested in the revisionist takeout letting him into NATO, no world leader who held that opinion would A, ever be let into NATO on a pure vote basis, but B, was fit to join NATO because once again, the Soviet Union was the driver of conflict in Western and Eastern Europe after the Cold, after World War II. Its dissolution, the agreement that the countries in Eastern Europe wanted to be free, that was the post-war, post-Cold War consensus. So but I think that's just what we're getting at, where this isn't being driven by empirical analysis of the dynamic. Because I think I would be really interested, and I know once again, you said this fairly, there are realists, isolationists, et cetera, who hold these perspectives, who are not just authoritarian simps here. But I would be interested in a conversation about, okay, it's the year 2000. You have a clearly dissatisfied with the status quo of Vladimir Putin. No, like he actually does think this about his former Eastern European countries. No, he clearly is a killer. He clearly isn't this like future Democrat who we could change by letting him into, you know, classical liberal ideas. However, if we don't integrate him somehow, we could see this potential path to chaos and destruction in this century. Therefore, how do we accommodate all of that within reason? That is a different point than letting Putin just say, look at me, I was a babe in the woods and Bill Clinton and everyone were mean to me. Because I really think like that there is the key differentiation between a good faith policy debate and a you once again have a demagogic ideological point you want to make.
We have to remember that the hopes were extremely high for Russia in the 1990s. The collapse of the Soviet Union caught most observers completely by surprise. And it seemed like the country had a way to emerge and seize the opportunity that it missed during World War I, that Russia could actually become a democracy. That was the hope. But instead, Russia seems to be captured by, you know, what the historian Richard Pipes, he talked about this patrimonial tradition in Russia. And it seems like, I mean, I don't want to sound like a cultural determinist, but it is shocking how Russia has regressed, and not just regressed into a czarist mold, but actually it seems to be heading down more towards a Stalinist path again. This really is a great tragedy. I guess the question would be, could the Clinton administration, did they bungle it during the 1990s? And did the Europeans as well? I mean, was there some kind of a Marshall Plan that could have been imposed or at least offered to Russia? Could we have done more? I don't know. Was this inevitable or was it a fluke that Yeltsin picked Putin? Those are questions, obviously, I can't answer. But I think what you're saying is correct. Those are more interesting questions than just saying, nah, the West is at fault.
I guess the question for you then would be, certain folks, especially on this old right that we see in like the modern public policy discourse, like they are really talking about how they are returning to, once again, this tradition that dates back to the start of the book here, and it's actually the neocons and the hawks that are out of step with actual tradition. Whenever folks talk about how the world has changed, I'm always interested in, well, what caused your view to fall out of fashion? The reason why their view fell out of fashion is they were just wrong on the central questions leading up to World War II. Not only were the Nazis and the Italian fascists ersatz models for what the Western future could look like, but they were actually genocidal conquerors who had their own designs and ambitions on the world that clearly would have affected the United States in a way the isolationist right was and left were incorrect about. That's what caused their viewpoint to not just be sustainable. And when you come to like Robert Taft and those other folks, they ended up falling out of favor because they were incorrect about the questions of the day. The way to secure America's future, the way to prevent World War III was not withdrawal behind our borders. It was a forward presence in Europe. Obviously, you go too far when you go to Vietnam and some of the other counterexamples, but at a bare minimum, NATO, Europe, that prevented the next generation from having to go fight World War III. What do you think the prospects are? Or let me put it this way. What are the central questions of this political moment that will determine whether or not right isolationism is going to be sustainable? Because that seems to me to be like the interesting thing that this will hinge on.
Well, as you're noting, I keep trying to say that this is a tradition, the old right, not the tradition in the GOP. There's been that constant tug of war between the internationalists and the Main Street populists. And that goes back to Teddy Roosevelt, the mugwumps, battles over World War I, entry into World War II. Let's not forget that Wendell Willkie was nominated in 1940, and he was an internationalist. So the old right has a sense of being dissed inside the GOP. And that's why National Review, William F. Buckley, saw Dwight Eisenhower as the real enemy, more than the liberals in the 1950s. They were obsessed. You know, the closer someone is to you ideologically, but if there's some distance, the more obsessed they tend to be with those differences. So the old right has finally become resurgent in the Republican Party today. And what is somewhat telling is the generational gap, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, guys in their 30s and 40s, Mitch McConnell, Mitt Romney. Romney's stepping down. McConnell's in his 80s. With the future of the party may actually be with the what we're calling the isolationist tradition, but the more accurate word probably is unilateralist. They're not opposed to using American military power. They just don't want it to be in tandem with allies or allied with international organizations. But right now, you'd have to say the old right is becoming the new establishment, and it's the establishment that are going to become the insurgency.
I have a bunch of different hats I wear. So I work across like center left spaces to center right to conservative spaces. And I'm curious what you think about this. I don't think especially if Trump wins in 2024, or just frankly, given the generational dynamic you really highlighted here, I struggle to see a world where, excluding Israel for a second, because that's once again where the generational democratic trends are complicated, where hawks, if you are a conservative who defines your conservatism through a foreign policy centric worldview, I do not see how you don't give up on the insurgency fight and instead just ally yourselves with the Democratic Party. Because at a core level, once again, beyond the issue of Israel, because that's the real mixer. Because also, I'm throwing a lot at you, but I just love this topic and I really loved your book, so I'm excited here. I think the funniest debate that you're seeing run here, and I've tried to tell this to people on the old right, or no, people on the institutional right who play footsie with the old right, they don't understand how Taiwan is clearly going to swing to the center left in the same way that Ukraine swung to the center left. You know, I said this to Bridge Colby, but I'm like, hey, Bridge, like, just so you know, man, like all these young American moment conservatives who are having you on the podcast and are thinking you're this paragon of realism and accuracy, they too are going to say, hey, wait a second, we believed that the Iraq war was bad because no blood for oil. Well, the next new old right term is going to be no blood for semiconductor chips. They are clearly literally going to say those words. And it's just wild to me that people in the right establishment think they could kind of ride the back of the tiger and keep it all together, because it just clearly isn't there. But yeah, sorry, rant over. What's your perspective on this?
That is, you know, I'm finding myself in total agreement with you. I never found Bridges' argument all that persuasive, which was dump Ukraine and focus on Taiwan. I think the Republican Party is going to dump it all. And the what's so interesting is that, to me, to get back to your earlier point, you were talking about my book on the neoconservatives. I feel like this book is focused on the analog of the neocons. That the neocons wanted to intervene everywhere. These guys want to intervene nowhere. To me, there are actually a lot of similarities between the two sides, at least emotionally and if not ideologically, that they're both tend to be extremists' views of foreign policy. Is there going to be some middle ground in their GOP? Probably not. Now, you already see people like Robert Kagan moving to the Democratic Party. And Max Boot is an independent, whereas he was once a Republican. So maybe that sifting process that you're talking about will occur. But that gets to a larger point. Can the Republican Party actually survive these splits?
I mean, the Republican Party could survive these splits because people still just aren't voting for foreign policy issues right now. Well, and actually, let me bring this back to the neocon point, because you know this history better than basically anyone, because you've written the book on it, literally. Neoconservatism, actually, and this is why I hate when people throw on the term neocon, because there's actually like a deep, serious intellectual movement here that matters. Neoconservatism actually begins as a domestic policy issue that expands outwards. Like neocon was a pejorative to describe certain members of like the Democratic Party who then went rightward. And then by the second generation, there's no real neoconservative domestic policy, then becomes more foreign policy centric. But I guess what I'm curious about here is, if you're basically painting the neocons as one end of the spectrum, and then the neo-isolationist is one of the other spectrum, how does this all tie together when it comes to domestic policy? Because, for example, J.D. Vance says great things, I think, about child policy. Like, I think we should have an expanded child tax credit. I think the Hungarians get weird. Once again, I've literally been at dinners with the Hungarian members of government. It gets weird very quickly. But, like, Elizabeth Warren is writing about the two-income trap in the 2000s, and there is this idea that this country is increasingly unaffordable for families, and for a variety of complicated post-sexual revolution reasons, the modern Democratic Party is less comfortable talking in that manner, in a way that provided an opening for people like Orrin Cass on the right. How does domestic policy tie this all together in a weird way?
You're right. The early neocons were focused on social policy. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Daniel Bell, Nathan Glaser, they wrote about issues like affirmative action and welfare, and they were dissenting from the mainstream Democrats, and they were attacked by Michael Harrington. I think he first used the word neocon to disparage their views. Today, there doesn't have to be a tie between your foreign policy views and domestic policy. There are a lot of libertarians out there, including with the Cato Institute, who do not believe in the kind of family policy that the people you're talking about endorse. But the wing of the Republican Party, the J.D. Vance, yes, they are trying to take out a more populist stance in the vein of Donald Trump. But the interesting thing is, what did Donald Trump actually do as president? He passed tax cuts. I see Republicans talking about these issues, but I didn't see very many of them voting for the Inflation Reduction Act that Biden passed. And Biden, to my eye, has done far more for the American family and for the economy than anything that the Republicans purport to support. So I think there is some hypocrisy there.
So here is how we'll tie everything together. Like you said, I want to juxtapose your framing of the neocons as one extreme and then neo-isolationists as another extreme. The question for the Republican conservative foreign policy apparatus is, can you find some middle? The middle doesn't have to be like squishy and moderate. There just is a middle point where I think we could agree, hey, the Iraq war was a bad idea. No one's going to defend that. And yes, it's true that NATO has to evolve to meet a different security situation than it was in the 1990s. What do you think that looks like? And what are the prospects for such a fusion happening?
In this regard, the most interesting characters in the Republican Party are people like former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, who is affiliated with the Nixon Foundation, and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. And I went to a Nixon library meeting here in Washington, D.C. at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel a couple months ago. And essentially, they are trying to blend the two. They're arguing for assertive American foreign policy, but at the same time, they denounce the idea of wars for democracy. They don't defend the Bush record. They argue that Biden, by practicing appeasement towards China, has weakened American power abroad. And then you have other people like Bridge Colby, who you mentioned, arguing for a much tougher policy towards China over Taiwan. So there are distinct wings in the Republican Party. And it is possible that you could have some amalgam. Now, the dream of O'Brien and Pompeo and others is that a second Trump presidency could be managed, that Trump would once more not be able to fulfill his dream of pulling out of NATO. Instead, his advisors would manipulate him as much as possible. The jury is out on that, of course, since Trump isn't president yet, but I think that Trump is much more aware of what occurred in the first term now. He's been radicalized. I think he's out for revenge and retribution. And I think his ambition will be, knowing that it's his last term as president, to enact a caesura in American history, to be the president who fundamentally reoriented the United States. Why wouldn't he go big?
That is an excellent place to end. I think what's very well stated in that is that I was thinking at first, well, I guess you would say the middle would be the way Trump acted during his first term. He, of course, goes to Europe. He causes lots of kerfuffles with NATO, but he also launches airstrikes against Assad. He takes the China policy, sends weapons to Ukraine after some controversies, obviously. But to your point, that was a scenario where Trump was probably maximally controllable and manipulable. That was not an organic Trump presidency in a way that it would be hard to imagine a second term operating in the same manner for good or for ill. So, like, you know, there's a world where you think that the withdrawal from Afghanistan was a good idea. That was the definition of an area where Trump was managed away from his natural instinct. So, I think that is a great place to end it. Jacob, could you just close by shouting out the book and that folks should definitely check out?
Sure. I have a copy of it right here. It's called America Last, The Right's Century-Long Romance with Foreign Dictators. You can pick it up at your independent local bookseller or on Amazon.
Thank you for joining me again on The Realignment.
Many thanks.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.